the views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Back for a return appearance here on Campus Voices. We're joined today by Adam Rome, the UNIDEL Helen Guldner Chair for the Environment and Professor of History and English. And he's also the co-director of the University's Environmental Humanities Program. And he's here to talk with us about the second annual
Lights, Camera, Earth Environmental Film Festival. Mitchell Hall, March 6th to 8th, 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock each day. That's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it's free and open to the public.
I'm so happy to hear you say those magic words, second annual, because when we talked last year, we were joking about, is this going to be the first annual?
Not only is it the second annual, but I've already got one filmmaker combo. Actually, it's a husband and wife ready to come for the third annual one next spring. So it was such a big success last year. We got great crowds, students, faculty, people from the community. We probably had too many films last year. We had 11, so we decided to cut back to 6 this year. No popcorn. I know that's a disappointment to you, Richard, but you were the only one, I think, that bought the popcorn last year.
Got to make some sacrifices. You've got a great lineup this year for this festival. You're really focusing on environmental documentaries.
Right. We did last year, too, that environmental documentary in the last couple years, last decade, has really become a big thing. You can see them in theaters now. That's really new. Probably that goes back to the Al Gore movie and Inconvenient Truth. The environmental documentaries have become a lot more creative, a lot more innovative in their cinematography and their plot lines and the way that they tell their stories. And so this year we wanted to showcase several subgenres of environmental filmmaking. And we ultimately came up with 6 that we're going to pick one example of each.
So it's not just environmental filmmaking in the sense that it's like long news stories all the time, is it?
Right. You know, before environmental documentary feature-length films, pretty much the only way that you could encounter environmental stories in a visual form would have been the classical journalistic reports on the network news starting in the 60s. And one of our genres is the exposé, that an effort to make you aware of a problem. But the exposé has really taken an interesting turn. It's not just that journalistic report. You've got The Cove, which is like Mission Impossible, getting into a secret story in a secret place. You've got Blue Vinyl, which we showed last year, which is expose in the form of family drama. Inconvenient Truth, expose in the form of PowerPoint presentation, if you can believe it. So that's one of our genres. We've got the art film. People have been making films about artists whose work gets at our relationship to the environment. A couple of them have been nominated for Academy Awards. We showed one last year, Chasing Ice, which was about James Balog, the photographer's effort to...
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
that was beautiful.
Yeah, it was stunning. Get us to think in new ways about climate change. We've got a biographical portrait. Filmmakers trying to give us hope in challenging times have often come to pick out incredibly courageous, determined, visionary individuals, some of them pretty famous, some of them not so famous. On our campus a few years ago, the student group of the Delaware Environmental Institute, showed The Island President, for example, which is about a guy who, first of all, had a heroic story just to become the president of the Maldives, fighting against the dictatorship and after prison, but then became a world leader in the battle for climate change. So we've got one of those as well, a biographical portrait. We've got stunt films. That's one of my favorite genres. And we showed an example last year, No Impact Man, where the writer Colin Bevan decided for a year in New York City with his wife and his little kid, he's going to try to live having no environmental impact, if you can believe it. And there are other films like that. There are stunt films that are road trips, your environmental road trip, where people a couple of 20-somethings spent the whole year traveling to all 50 states looking for the hippest, coolest environmental success stories. So that's another genre, the stunt film. Then we've got the can-do cheerleading call to action. And again, that's fairly new. Environmentalists have gotten a rap over the years, doom and gloomers, downbeat. And some of the films about environmental subjects definitely make it hard to go home and just live a normal life afterward. But there have been a lot more lately that have really been trying to cheer us on, to show us success stories, people really working to solve problems. And we've got one of those to start our festival, actually.
Yeah, that's the first film in the festival, which will be Friday, March the 6th at 4 o'clock, is Carbon Nation.
Carbon Nation is, I'd say it's the most ambitious of these can-do documentaries. The director, Peter Beich, set out to make, in his words, an optimistic, solutions-based, non-preachy, non-partisan, big tent film about energy. And he hoped that it would even be a film that would appeal to people who aren't convinced about climate change. And I think it starts, the wit of the film, even with the promotional poster, which recalls the iconic photograph of the flag raising at Iwo Jima during World War II. It shows a group of people raising up a wind tower. That image became a symbol of American resolve, and I think Carbon Nation celebrates a new kind of American hero, all the dreamers, the problem solvers who are helping to move the nation beyond fossil fuels. Some of them are real characters, too. They're larger than life. They're just fascinating to get to know. Others are a little more aw-shucks, modest people. And there will be a lot of surprises. The former head of the CIA turns out to be a big booster for the electric car. The military has its own band of, by their own lights, Green Hawks, who are trying to get the military to do new things with energy and then ultimately have that turn into civilian use as well.
One of the things that's unique about the Lights, Camera, Earth film festivals is each film is introduced by somebody. Who's going to introduce Carbon Nation?
Ismat Shah from Materials Science. And you're right. I'm glad you brought that up again, Richard, because that's one of the distinctive things about the festival. You get to see everything on the big screen, and that is really cool, especially for some of these visually stunning films. We also have a faculty member introducing each film, and then we have an open discussion afterward with the audience led by the faculty member. So we've got Ismat Shah for Carbon Nation. Breathing Earth, our second film on Friday night, we've got Vimalan Rajavisharakul from Art History. And then we've got McKay Jenkins from English for our Saturday film, King Corn. Saturday night, we've got a guest here as well, a writer who is also the narrator of the film. I'll be leading the discussion with him and the audience afterward. Sunday afternoon, we have another genre, which I forgot, the closely observed, immersive people in place story. And we've got Susan Strasser from History to talk about and lead the discussion of Garbage Dreams. Then Sunday night, the biographical portrait, Bitter 70. We've got Tom Powers from Philosophy leading that discussion. And then we have, I should have also mentioned, the winner of the Student Film Festival, Student Environmental Film Competition, sponsored by the Delaware Environmental Institute's Students Program Committee. We're giving away $1,000 to the best 5-minute film. It's judged by students, and we've got the head of that committee, Becky Bronstein, coming to introduce the winning film, and the filmmaker will be there.
That'll be the way you end on Sunday, March the 8th. But let's get back to the program for Friday, March 6th, where at 7 o'clock you have what I consider the date movie of the of the festival, Breathing Earth.
That's funny, Richard. So Breathing Earth is, we try to have Friday night and Saturday night showstoppers. And Breathing Earth is a film that you can't see any other way. It hasn't been released on DVD. It's not available for online streaming. I don't believe that it's played in any theater, even art house series, anywhere in our region. In fact, I had to deal with a distributor in Paris who was kind of a pill to deal with, to be honest, but we got it. So we've got Breathing Earth. It's a stunningly beautiful film, and it's actually the second stunningly beautiful film about an artist who works with nature by the director, the German director, Thomas Riedelsheimer. His earlier film from about a decade ago, Rivers and Tides, just blew me away when I first saw it. It's about a Scottish artist, a sculptor who makes earthworks out of ice and driftwood and mud and leaves and stones. They're all pretty much ephemeral, but they're stunningly beautiful while they last. So this is kind of a sequel. Breathing Earth focuses on a Japanese sculptor who's actually got an even more interesting life than the star of Rivers and Tides. He's about 75, I think, and he's works with wind. All of his sculptures try to show us the majesty of wind. His dream is to build an eco-village that would be a place to inspire a sense of wonder that would be powered by beautiful windmills. So his name, Susumu Shingo, I should have mentioned, but Susumu Shingo goes with his wife, Yasuko, to Italy, to Germany, to Scotland, to Turkey, in search of a site for what he calls his Breathing Earth Center. All those places that he goes are stunningly beautiful. And so are his sculptures. He says about the wind, it's the absolute. It's old as the earth. It knows no boundaries. Compared to the wind, humans are short-lived, fragile creatures. But the wind is invisible. We can only see it when it touches something else. And that's what his sculptures allow us to do, is to see the wind moving. And the film director has done a great job of not only showing his sculptures, but in other ways, giving us that impression of the wind moving. The sculptures are really cool. The film ends with a stunning scene.
This isn't a spoiler, no, is it?
No, it's not. It's a teaser. But Shingo and his wife are sitting at the coast, and he's made sculptures that are out on the water, and the sun is setting, and his wife says, which is more beautiful, the sculptures or the sunset? And I think that's really the whole message of the movie. Is it possible for humans to make a built environment, a world, that's as beautiful as the natural world? That should be our goal.
Shingo just sounds charming, and because the film starts off with him interacting with children and their kites, and then, as you're saying, it ends with these sculptures that display the wind, the natural power, and then the actual sunset.
Yeah, he is charming, and he's got an amazing story of how he got to be interested in what he's doing. And like you said, kids are really his inspiration, that he really hopes adults can regain that childlike sense of wonder. So the opening scene, he's working with a bunch of kids, and he invites them to make kites that would be soaring wishes. You all have your dreams of what you want to be when you grow up, he says. Write your dreams on the kites and fly them in the sky, and then hopefully they'll come true. And then he tells them his dream. So you're never too young to dream, and you're never too old to wonder.
Coming up Saturday, March the 7th, you start off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with a really fun stunt film from 2007.
King Korn. That stars, although it's not directed by one of the filmmakers we had as a guest last year, Ian Chaney. We showed his City Dark on Saturday night last year. It was a huge hit, great crowd, a film about the night sky and what we lose when we can't see the night sky. So King Korn was his breakthrough film. He and a buddy, right after they graduated from Yale, they both were from Iowa, decide that they're going to go back to Iowa and rent 1 acre of a cornfield and try to grow their own corn and then see what happens to the corn after they grow it. And along the way, they're going to learn a hell of a lot, they hope, about our modern agricultural system, the social costs, the environmental costs of modern agriculture. And it got tremendous, tremendous play when it first came out in 2007. It won an award, and I love the, and I know you do too, the citation from the George Foster Peabody Committee. Think of it as Ian and Kurt's excellent agricultural adventure, they said. College buddies Ian Chaney and Kurt Ellis, regular dudes who consume large quantities of junk food and wear their baseball caps backwards, get a wild post-grad notion that they should grow an acre of corn and observe their harvest as it goes to market and manufacturing.
Now, they end up losing sight of their corn. It took them 18 minutes to harvest it from their 1 acre because it just goes into the system, but they then still follow through the system, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so yeah, it's actually stunningly anticlimactic. You know, they're there for months, and then at the end of the day, it takes them, as you say, 18 minutes to go circle around their 1 acre. They get 180 bushels, which is a little less than the county average. It's nothing to brag about, but it wasn't bad. But then for them, one of the most interesting things is trying to figure out what happens to the corn. And it's impossible. They drive it down to the silo at the elevator, the county elevator, and then it could become ethanol for cars. It could become sweetener for virtually anything, for soft drinks. It could become cattle feed or something else. They don't know for sure because commodity corn is turned into literally thousands of things. It could become plastic. Corn is everywhere, and we're all part corn. But when it's in the field, the other one of their other revelations, they actually go out and they taste it a little before they harvest it, and they almost throw up. I mean, it tastes like sawdust or chalk. Until it's processed, it's just hopelessly inedible.
That's King Corn on Saturday afternoon. Saturday evening at 7 o'clock, you've got Jeff Goodall, who writes for Rolling Stone magazine, talking about his movie, Dirty Business, which I think is him revisiting places he first visited when he was writing a book called Big Coal.
Right. So he about 5 years before the film, Jeff Goodall writes a book, Big Coal. And it's worth going back to say a little bit more about Jeff Goodall, because I'm so excited that he's coming. So he's been a Rolling Stone writer since 1996. He grew up in Silicon Valley, and his first two books were about Silicon Valley. One is about the industry. One was about his own family. His dad was, I think, an aerospace engineer. And so he's got this very American, very Silicon Valley-ish booster sense of what technology can do. But his third book was about a coal mining disaster, and it's just called Our Story. And it's about a bunch of miners who were trapped in Pennsylvania underground for 77 hours and really didn't have any idea that coal was still so important in our country. You know, coal fueled the Industrial Revolution of the late 19th century, 100 years ago. And it seemed like a dirty, grimy, historic anachronism. But he was shocked to find out that we're using more coal than ever. He got an invitation to go and explore the whole industry, which he does in this best-selling book, Big Coal. And then for the film, Dirty Business, he goes back to see many of the people and the places that he wrote about, and also to see what's changed, whether we've done anything in that time to try to live up to the promise that the industry keeps touting, that we can have clean coal, and as well as what we've done to work out alternatives to coal, since it turns out he's a skeptic about whether coal can ever be clean.
Well, I get the sense, seeing things like the 60 Minutes piece on the coal industry in North Carolina this fall, that clean coal is an oxymoron.
I think he thinks that too. So mostly when people talk about clean coal, and he talks to a government scientist who's a super smart booster of this idea, they're talking about when you actually burn it in the utility plant, can you capture the carbon dioxide and the other pollutants? That's possible, but so far, prohibitively expensive. And it's also not clear that it could be done on the scale of a whole nation. You might be able to do it with a plant or two right now, but not a whole nation. But what makes him convinced, Jeff Goodall, that we can't have clean coal in a broader sense is, as you say, at every other stage, the mining of it, the transporting of it, there are dangers. And many of us know about individual parts of the problem, you know, mountaintop removal in West Virginia, where these huge slurry pits where coal is processed, like you mentioned in North Carolina. But this film really puts it all together. It really tries to give you a very visually striking sense of the true costs of the energy, the electricity that we take for granted. And as I say, though, it also looks at the alternatives. Goodall has no patience for the obfuscations, really the lies of the coal industry. But he does believe that we can build another better, modern 21st century energy system. And the film goes beyond the book in trying to show some of those alternatives. Talking with him afterward, I'm really excited about, because just as with film, writers about environmental issues have also been experimenting with ways of telling their stories, how to engage readers with subjects that can be complex and controversial and even depressing. And Jeff Goodall is one of the few people who's had the chance to both write about it and also make a movie about it. And to hear him reflect Saturday night, March 7th, on some of the differences and the similarities between film and book writing as media, I think is going to be cool.
Then we come to Sunday, March 8th, where you've got three events at 4 o'clock. the movie Garbage Dreams, and then the 7 o'clock, the movie Bitter 70, which is in my Netflix queue, and the results of the student video competition finalists. I'm really looking forward to Garbage Dreams just because it's from 2009, and it's about those famous Zabayin of Cairo, the independent garbage processors who are so efficient and behind the scenes of daily life in Cairo.
Yeah, the Garbage Dreams was a revelation for me when I first saw it. And the filmmaker, Mai Iskander, she's Egyptian-American and ultimately spent about 4 years making the film, which really illustrates this whole subgenre, this immersive people-in-place storytelling, close observation. So the Zabayin, they're illiterate, they're poor. To the outside world, if you don't know anything about them, they look backward. But in fact, they have the world's most efficient garbage recycling system. They recycle about 80% of all the garbage that they collect from Cairo, this huge, huge city of 10 plus million people. And the drama of the film is that the city government decides that it is going to hire international waste management firms to collect the garbage instead.
Modernize.
Exactly, exactly. And they create the first landfills. One of the most charming moments of the film, although it's also poignant, is when the three kids who are the stars of the film first see a landfill. They didn't even know that there was such a thing, and they're just blown away by the wastefulness of it. They can't believe that mountains and mountains of trash just getting buried. So the Zabayin are trying to figure out, as the film goes on, how they can survive as a community. They're an ethnic minority in Egypt. They're Christians, so they're Arab by race, but they're Christian by belief. They have this sense of mission, so they don't want to give it up. And the film focuses on these three kids. They're all teenagers. They've never been in a movie before, of course. The filmmaker finds them through a recycling school that's started by the community as part of its effort to try to show the city that they can be the best of the old and the best of the new, that they can do everything that the internationals can do, but much, much better. So these three kids at the recycling school, Adam, Nabil, and Osama, are just fascinating. Osama's kind of the hard luck, can't do anything right, just wants respect guy. But the other two are clearly leaders in the making. They have visions of what they can do and dreams. And the film follows them as they come to terms with this really traumatic set of changes in their life. But they also get some opportunities through the school. Another really charming scene is when the two leaders, Adam and Nabil, are sent by their school to Wales to see the state-of-the-art European recycling center. And they're on the one hand, they're blown away. They've never been out of the country. They've never really even been out of Cairo. So they've never seen modern consumer culture. They've never seen modern technology. But even there, they are surprised at how inefficient it is compared to what they're used to. Here there is technology, Adam says, but no precision. But they go back inspired by it. And I think the film ultimately raises a question that goes beyond Cairo and beyond the fate of the Zabayin, because there are lots and lots of old ways of doing things that were more resource efficient, more energy efficient than the 20th century or 21st century things that have replaced them. And we may have to go and borrow some of that wisdom if we're going to deal with the challenges of the 21st century.
And you've got the perfect match as a moderator for that film and your colleague Susie Strasser.
Right, who wrote a wonderful book, Waste and Want, A Social History of Trash in America. And America's a perfect example. 100 years ago, we had, before anyone used the word recycling, an incredible system because we were a poor country. We had to find ways to turn rags into paper and to turn bones into, you know, grease and various other things. So there was an incredible system for collecting stuff that people couldn't use anymore than individually, but could be used industrially. And that all went, you know, the way of history in the 20th century. So she'll be a fabulous discussion leader. I think they all will, but she's a wonderful colleague, and she just retired, and I miss her, and I'm so glad that she's going to be coming back for our film festival.
Now, Sunday night, this is the last outside film, if you will, Bitter 70, which that's bitter, not bitter, Bitter 70, which is sort of a subversive, I wouldn't call it stunt, but it's sort of about the growing awakening of the main character in this movie.
So the main character is a student. That was one reason I thought it would be great as a way to close the festival. He's a student in Utah. He's in his 20s. Although he's been interested in environmental stuff and he loves the outdoors, he really didn't plan on doing what he did, which was to ultimately, in an act of civil disobedience, monkey wrench a sale of mineral rights in Utah. So monkey wrench is a phrase that comes from Edward Abbey, envisioned in a novel, a future eco-activist who would, in various ways, try to sabotage modern industrial life. The student, Tim DeChristopher, goes to this sale. It's at the end of the Bush administration. He thinks the sale is illegal, that they haven't done the proper things to prepare for the sale. And it turns out the government ultimately agrees with him when the administration changes. But he bids on all these mineral rights with no intention of paying. He doesn't have any money. But he wants to stop the energy companies from buying up these rights and then using them. And the only thing he can think of is to buy them himself, which is a crime. It's a federal crime. And so he's arrested, even though ultimately the government agrees that the sale shouldn't have happened. He's arrested for trying to derail it. And then the government, I guess, was not clear about how to deal with him. And he doesn't go to trial for 2 years. And the film follows him through that 2 years. And it's an incredibly vivid portrait of a guy preparing for an uncertain future. He could end up going to jail, maybe even for quite a length of time. He might just be slapped on the wrist and fined. He might even be acquitted. He's hoping that he'll have a chance to explain why he did what he did to a jury, that he really wants people to think about what we're doing to get the energy that we need and whether it's worth it. But he's really prepared all along for the possibility that he'll go to jail. That's part of civil disobedience, is willing to pay the price. So in that 2 years, he meets with a scientist who was the one who first made him think about climate change. Very poignant scene. The scientist, she's a little anxious that maybe she's in some way responsible for the possibility that he might go to jail. But he actually is so grateful to her, and still is. He gets help from his church. They buoy him up. He goes to see some anti-war activists from the 60s who went to jail for protesting against the Vietnam War. He goes back with his brother to West Virginia, where he grew up and first came to love the outdoors. He goes hiking again and again in the beautiful canyons of Utah to remind himself what's really at stake. Although he hopes to be acquitted, he's not willing to shut up while he's waiting trial. So he starts speaking out, and he becomes a famous activist on climate change issues and an inspiration to people around the country who really are praying for him, as well as drawing inspiration from him. So it's an incredibly interesting film that raises great questions about what might be our responsibilities, our duties, if we really take seriously the challenges that we face.
After Bitter 70 gets done, it'll be time for
the winner of the student video competition. This is actually the third annual one. They started it even before we had the film festival. Again, it's the Delaware Environmental Institute Student Program Committee's group that's done this. They've gotten some great submissions in the past. I'm hoping that we'll get our best ever collection to look at. And the theme was a personal journey this year. So I think that also goes perfectly with Bitter 70. It doesn't really matter if you understand this stuff intellectually. It's got to become part of you in some way. There's always some story of how you get to the point where you care enough to do something. And I'm really excited to see what the students come up with.
Adam, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us about the second annual Lights, Camera, Earth Environmental Film Festival. It'll be held in Mitchell Hall on the university campus, March 6th to the 8th. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The price is right. It's
free and open to the public. Thanks so much, Richard. Always a blast.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.